Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson. In this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Ada Bernier, the founder and CEO of SkillCrush, a leading online education platform that helps people learn valuable tech skills, whether that's to transition careers, launch a freelance business, or to start building your own products. Ada, originally a student in fine arts at Yale University, first made her way into the workforce as an artist assistant and eventually found herself in the media industry. Now, this was in 2009, which was a very tumultuous time for economies around the world, and living in New York City, working as a media assistant did not make Ada immune to the mass layoffs that were happening all around her. After getting laid off, she looked around and noticed that the only people at her previous company who'd kept their jobs were those with technical skills, the web developers and designers who actually built and maintained the company's websites. That was a defining moment for Ada, and it was right here that her journey into coding got started. Over the course of the next couple of years, she'd teach herself how to code, collaborate to build side projects with friends and mentors, and eventually that led her to launching SkillCrush, her company that's dedicated to teaching tech skills with a primary focus on serving women who've traditionally been underrepresented in these roles. Since 2012, SkillCrush has grown to more than 15,000 students served. And in this episode, Ada and I talk about her journey from studying fine arts to uncovering her deep interest in understanding the way websites worked and how that led her down a long, winding path of learning to code. We dig into the actual tactics and strategies Ada used to attract the first couple thousand email subscribers for SkillCrush, including a trip to South by Southwest, and how they then made their first $1,200 launching an ebook to that audience. We cover the major milestones SkillCrush has had over the past few years, how they've scaled online courses while maintaining a very personalized experience, her best advice for building an online business, and more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Ada Bernier.
Ada, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So I want to start this off by hearing, what book are you reading or what's been your most favorite recently?
That's a good question. So I'm actually reading a book called Chelsea Girls by Eileen Miles, I believe. I keep like mispronouncing her last name. And so far, I really love it. It's kind of, she's a poet, but this is a novel. Well, it's an autobiographical novel about sort of her youth, coming of age, I guess, or whatever, in New York. And I really was enjoying it because it's kind of told in these, like, each chapter is its own story. And the most recent chapter was about her going out into Queens and taking the same subway train I take to get diet pills. And how she would do this every month. Because, like, diet pills, especially in that time period, were effectively speed. And then she would, like... Mm-hmm. She would sell them to her friends anyways. It was just very funny because she was just talking about all these things that, like, you know, Roosevelt Avenue and the 7 train and bars and, like, I don't know, it was just all the stuff that, like, I live around, but it's also very different now. So I was enjoying, you know, that sort of little look at old New York.
Yeah, and I guess pretty enterprising too in her own way.
Yeah.
So Ada, where are you originally from?
So I was actually born in Iceland. I have Icelandic parents, but I grew up in California, Santa Barbara, California.
Wow, that is quite a bit different. What age did you move to Santa Barbara?
I was really young. I was only a couple of months old. But we spent a lot of time in Iceland when I was growing up. Like, we would often sort of leave the day after school ended for the summer and then come back the day before school started in the fall. So I spent a lot of time back and forth, especially when I was younger.
Man, that's awesome. What did your parents do when you were growing up?
They are both academics. So my dad is a professor. He teaches math. And my mom is an anthropologist. And so she has both lectured and then also participated in a lot of different sort of, you know, academic writing, book, documentary projects, that kind of thing. And she studies, you know, gender issues specifically. So it's definitely
that's awesome.
An influence on my life.
Were they, yeah, I was going to ask, were they sort of like the exemplary path that you sort of saw your life going in when you were at least a kid? Or do you have something else in mind?
You know, I think that I don't know that I ever wanted to, no, I can say that I never really wanted to be a professor. I don't know that I really, I think like, you know, honestly, like looking back on it, I feel like my ideas for what I could be were relatively narrow in scope. So I think, you know, there's a lot of awesome things about having academic parents and also academia in general, but it definitely didn't necessarily give me like a wide exposure. Excuse the outdoor noise, but yeah, so I don't think I wanted to do what my parents did. It is funny to me that I don't even have a graduate degree. That is sort of feels like some sort of weird failure, or so I don't know, failure is strong, but it's like a funny thing that like everyone in my family has at least a master's degree and I only have a college degree, and that seems a little bit funny. But I think growing up, you know, I wanted to be an astronaut at one point. I wanted to be a lawyer.
Well, you shouldn't be that ashamed, because, you know, fast forwarding a little bit now for everyone listening, Ada graduated from Yale with a BA in fine arts in 2007. So at that point in time, what kind of career were you sort of expecting to have graduating from college?
When I graduated college, I was both, I mean, I was thinking I was going to be an artist. So I was looking at working for artists, working in production, and sort of explore that as an avenue. And then I would say I kind of had one of those things where then like the thing I was doing on the side was more like internet media journalism work. And sort of very quickly, I kind of felt like going into the arts was, at least just short term in terms of a way to make money, was a non-starter. So then I started to kind of explore journalism and working in media it was a more viable career path at that point. So that was kind of what I was thinking. But I think a lot of it too is just, you know, it was a lack of exposure to other opportunities and other ideas, right? Like it's sort of I don't know if it's a lack of imagination, but just a lack of other examples. Like I think, you know, coming from an academic background and then going to a liberal arts college, like all I really saw, it was sort of like become a consultant or a lawyer or a doctor, none of which appealed to me at that point, or, you know, work in the arts or be an academic. That was kind of my range of options. So I was like, artist, I picked that one. And then luckily, when I graduated and started working, I saw that there was a much, much bigger range of options.
What was that first job you took when you graduated?
My very first job, I honestly couldn't tell you. I just did like a whole bunch of different odd jobs. I was actually thinking about this yesterday because, we had a student who was asking advice and was talking about sort of needing to make money. And I started thinking about like all the different things that I did. And I mean, I did a lot of different things, like, yeah, babysitting. I was working production. I was working for artists as an assistant. I was, you know, ended up freelancing. I think making an honest day's work is an honest day's work. And I was really happy to do basically anything because I needed the money. And at that point was kind of cobbling together an income. But yeah, so I think probably my first like job, quote unquote, that I would call a job was like working as an artist assistant. And then my first full-time job was actually working as a photo editor for an online magazine, which sounds fancy, but it wasn't fancy at all. I was literally just like cropping images in Photoshop and uploading them into a CMS. So
now you start to make steps into kind of this media world, right? And you said, you know, taking on a full-time job with that. At what point do technical skills begin to be something that you care about?
It was right at that point when I became a photo editor. So the photo editor in this online magazine sat on the production side of the house. And it's funny because it was literally like an office and it was divided into editorial over here and production over here. And so even though I had this like editor title, they put me in production. And what that meant was that I was managed by one of the developers and kind of considered as part of that team. And that was really the first time where I even encountered like met a developer, right? And started to learn about what it was that they did and started to learn about this thing called code. And I remember they talked about like HTML and CSS and they were like these foreign languages. It was such a like, you know, mystery clouded in like, I don't know. It was just very, very, very unfamiliar to me. But that was kind of my first exposure, and sort of very slowly, I mean, it was like peeling back layers of an onion. And I think like it started with kind of me being like, well, seeing some opportunities, like I thought that some of the features of the site were not great and could be improved. And so that kind of led to some discussions of like, how does this work? How do we make changes? How do we know if we're doing the right thing? And that kind of thing. And then I started basically doing some product development with them. It was so simple. Like there was one of the magazines I photo edited for, it was about art, and that was why they'd hired me. And so you could click on the images in the email and see a bigger image, but there was no clicking through like a slideshow. And so this is like 2008, and slideshows were pretty basic back then. Today they're like, duh. But anyway, so I was kind of like, wouldn't it be cool if we could like click through to the next image and you didn't have to go back to the email every time? So they were like, yeah, we should do that. And then they're like, oh, we could put ads on the slideshow. And then I remember I got like, I think like they instituted something where it was like, if you had an idea and it like increased page views by some amount, you could get like $100 or something. And so I remember like months later, they're like, oh yeah, that was technically Ada's idea. And there was some dispute about whose idea it was to do the slideshow. Anyway, that was my first adventures in product development. And that was my first exposure. So then it was kind of like understanding like, oh, well, what does it take to create this slideshow feature? You know, how does it work? What's the coding behind it? Who all has to get involved? And all of that. So
at this point, you have the interest clearly, right? Like you start to think, okay, what's actually powering these changes, these features? When did that turn into you actually learning and developing and spending the time to build this skill yourself rather than just observe?
Yeah. So, that sparked my interest, obviously. And like I said, it was like peeling layers of the onion. You kind of like eventually you get to the one that's like the coding layer. And that's sort of a huge barrier. And I think it's a big barrier for a lot of people. And it was certainly for me. And I think I like danced around that one for a long time and thought about it a lot and did a lot of like talking about it, but was very, very intimidated by it, to be honest. And really, you know, I really did, like, if I'm honest with myself and with everyone on this podcast, I think for a very long time, I had this like idea. It was like, here I was like 24 or something. And, had kind of been reasonably successful by whatever measures you can call like a 24-year-old successful in terms of like, I got into a school that I wanted to get into, I got good grades, all of that. But I really like had this fear that coding was going to be like, I was going to like finally hit my limit. Like I did. I like had this anxiety that like I wasn't going to be able to do it. And that was, I was going to like realize the limitation of my like intellectual capability. So I talked about it for a very long time and thought about it for a very long time before I actually did it. And then what really pushed me over the edge was I left the job at the online magazine, got another job at a digital ad agency. And this is like 2009. So everything in New York is just like a complete disaster, especially in the media world. And I was at that job for six or seven weeks before I got laid off. And the job I had at that point was a digital producer. So I wasn't a technical person. And when they laid me off, they basically gutted all the non-technical departments in the company. And that was kind of that moment for me where both I needed money. But second of all, I also really kind of got the strong message that in this industry, if I didn't have technical skills, I was going to be expendable in a way that somebody with technical skills wasn't. So that kind of was enough motivation to get me over that fear and to actually dive in and start to learn to code myself.
So let's talk about that learning component. Was this pretty much like a self-taught journey for you, or did you have mentors, training programs you were following? What did that sort of look like?
Yeah, I mean, it was self-taught, but heavily supported by friends of mine who basically took pity on me and answered my questions and sort of guided me in the right direction. I mean, it's amazing to think back because it wasn't that long ago. Like this is probably 2009. This is 2009. But there really weren't, none of the boot camps existed. I think there were some classes you could take at NYU, but like they cost a lot of money and I didn't have any money. And just really weren't a lot of options. So I literally, you know, asked some friends for guidance, did some Googling on the internet, bought a book at Barnes & Noble, and kind of just, you know, and I had the benefit of being unemployed and therefore having a lot of time on my hands. So then I just kind of banged my head against, you know, the wall until something started to happen. But I will say, and this has been a big insight in terms of how we have developed Skill Crush, you know, looking back on it, I did really realize that a key part of it was that I did have people who could, even if they weren't literally teaching me, they could tell me, yes, you're going in the right direction. And that, I think, was absolutely critical. I don't know that I could have done it if I hadn't had those people to be like, yes, you should learn PHP, or, you know what I mean? Like, or, you know, here's a couple key things, or, hey, like, I just Google everything. So you can Google things too, that kind of guidance.
Do you remember the first side project that you built using your skills?
Yeah, I think to start, I think I literally just, you know, doodled around and like made some random ass websites. I very quickly got a freelance project, that paid me, which was amazing and really, really necessary because I wasn't making any money. But I actually would say like the first like real, what I would call like a side project, that was really substantial was a, website that I built with two friends of mine that we, actually submitted back in 2010. Bloomberg at the time was trying to stoke the tech industry in New York, and Michael Bloomberg, the mayor, and he did this thing called the Big Apps Competition, which they actually still do. And basically what they did is they took all this like state and city data and made it public and then said, hey, app developers, take this data, do something cool with it, and then submit it to us for, you know, prizes and notoriety. And, you know, at the time, like, I was just starting to freelance. I had just gotten sort of like a part-time or like a freelance gig as a technical producer. I basically was just like trying to get as much experience and exposure as possible to the tech industry. And so I talked this guy that I knew who's a developer and this woman I knew who's a designer into sort of collaborating on a project to submit to the Big Apps competition. And we created this website called Big Apple Ed. And we took all the public school data and created profiles for every single public school in New York and kind of like, you know, tried to show like, oh, their test rankings and all the kind of important data that you would want to know. And that was kind of my first kind of start to finish experience of building a more complicated web application that also used a lot of data and was completely self-directed. So I would say that was kind of a really important step in my development as, you know, a technical product kind of person.
So let's talk about Skill Crush now, which is the company that you founded back in 2012. Did Skill Crush start out as one of these little side projects, or would it have some other origin story?
No, very much started as a side project. At that point, starting in 2010, I started what was basically a design and development agency with the same group of friends that I had made the Big Apple Ed with. And we were doing a lot of freelance projects and sort of doing stuff for fun on the side. And Skill Crush really started completely as a side project. And like by side project, I mean like the lowest priority side project, but kind of the one that we would do for fun. And we actually called it Digital Divas. And I'm actually realizing, I would have to dig around too much of my files, but it was actually literally wasn't even digital. It was analog. It was a card deck that we created. Wow. And it's like this little card deck. I'll have to find it for you. Actually, I think I can send you the PDF of it. But basically, it was a card deck, and they were pink, and they were called Digital Diva Deck. And it basically was like each card defined like a technical term in like a fun and easy to understand way and was illustrated. And it was just something, it was like, you know, it was like, we didn't even know the term MVP at that point, but I feel like it was like our MVP of trying to express ourselves in the way. It was basically like we had this desire, myself and my partner in that firm or that company that we were running, where we were both women and there was, you know, not a lot of women in tech. And we sort of felt like the way that tech was being talked about, like the way that coding and all that stuff was being talked about, really didn't represent our experience of it. And we felt like it was, you know, much friendlier, much easier to understand, and also like a lot more creative and interesting than the way it was being represented in the media. And we were trying to figure out a way to, like, you know, depict it or talk about it in a way that fit our experience. And yeah, that's how it all started.
Well, I love that it started with this sort of mission, like an ethos behind it too.
Yes, for sure.
So let's talk about your first paying student with SkillCrush, or maybe it's with Digital Diva Deck. Which one was it? Was it when you had the full website, the platform up, or was it someone who paid to learn from you guys back when it was more of an MVP?
You know, you ask a very good question that I actually am not sure I know the answer to. Like when we made our first, literally when we made our first dollar, I don't know the answer to that question. We probably don't know that we ever sold the Digital Diva decks. I know we thought about selling them, but I'm not sure that we actually did. We did make a website for them though, which I bet I could find. The first time we made a dollar for SkillCrush that I would consider like our first dollar, was really important because it was actually after we had launched our first tutorials and we had launched our first, so we had built sort of like a very bare bones version of what is now our platform. And launched a couple of tutorials and we'd gotten a bunch of free signups, so we weren't charging for it yet. And we basically, I started to do some customer discovery to try to figure out if anyone would pay for additional ones. And there was not a real positive signal. So we actually did have this, I had a good moment with a mentor of mine who was like, okay, listen, like, here's the thing. You have this list. At that point, we had a newsletter list of like a couple thousand. And he was like, the thing that you need to determine right now is whether they're going to be monetizable at all. Like, we had this fantasy that they would pay us, I don't even remember what it was, probably $25 a month or something like that on a subscription. But he was like, listen, like, the biggest jump is from zero to dollar. So what you need to determine is whether this list is going to give you any money ever. And then he was like, getting them from a dollar to $25 or more is going to be much easier than getting to them from zero to a dollar. So we actually ran a contest, and the contest was, well, it wasn't really, I don't know if you'd call it a contest. I don't know. Some sort of something. It was like user voted topic. Like we said, okay, we're going to put together an ebook and it's going to cost $5. If you pre-order it, and $9 once it's out, and you can determine what the topic is going to be. So we had our newsletter list vote on the topic, and then they could buy it at a 50% discount. And we basically did this all in a week. So we like ran the contest and then made the ebook. I think it was like Monday to Friday. And I don't remember how many purchases we got, but I think the total amount we made was like $1,200. Which to us was like, holy crap, this is amazing. And it was really good because it did tell us that, yes, like our audience was monetizable. We just hadn't figured out what the product was to monetize them on exactly. I would say that was really kind of our first significant.
I like that a lot. I actually want to take one step back to something that you mentioned. You said that, you know, before you started monetizing your audience, you had built up a list of a couple thousand people, maybe. How were you doing that? Because that's something that a lot of people listening here today have a major challenge with, just building that community in the first place.
Yeah, and it's really hard. So I don't want to, and I look back on it actually, and it felt really hard at the time for us. And yet I look back and I'm like, it actually worked really well. You know what I mean? Like in retrospect, like if I were to start something new today, I would actually have much lower expectations than what, I guess, like, you know, when you've never done anything before, you're like, I want 100,000 people on my email list in the next month. And then you're like, oh, I got 10. Okay. The delta between my expectations. But, so I would actually like, I feel like I would even have lower expectations now, than I did then. But, yeah, I mean, basically, we had had sort of this bad experience, which in retrospect wasn't that bad, but I'm really thankful for it, which is that we had tried to make the software product that was like a tablet publishing software product, which like made a lot of sense in 2012. But it was definitely one of those experiences of like a solution in search of a problem. Like we hadn't really validated this as a real customer pain point. And so that really put me off of doing things that way. I was like, I'm not going to make that mistake again. So when we started SkillCrush, I really, really wanted to validate it before we started. And for me, the easiest way I could see to validate it to begin with was actually with a newsletter list. which turned out to be a brilliant marketing strategy, but I wasn't even thinking about it like that. I just figured that, like, you know, because we didn't have anything to sell to use to validate it, the currency that was being exchanged instead in my mind was the email. So I was like, okay, if I can get people to sign up for a free email, then that's a good sign I'm going in the right direction. So to kick it off, the very first thing we did was in March of 2012, we kind of had this idea for Skill Crush. I mean, we'd already been working on the digital view deck, but we were starting to think about it as like an actual viable business. And what we did is we came up with this idea of a product, and that product was a newsletter that explained technology in an interesting and creative way. And that was kind of like the MVP of, we joke at Skill Crush, the minimal viable, you know what I mean? Like that's the MMM of our product. And what I thought was, we were already planning to go to South by Southwest, and we were like, okay, like let's, and you have to remember too that here we were very focused on women, and that was just something that wasn't validated in the market at all. I mean, I think you could argue it's still kind of questionably validated, but at the time it was like super not validated. There was like no women in tech basically. So I, you know, that our thinking was, okay, we've got this newsletter idea. The email will be how people pay for it. And if we can't convince women at South by Southwest to do this, then like we don't have a shot in hell, because that's the most likely group to like it. And I think we went into South by Southwest thinking like, oh, we'll get 1,000 signups or something like that. And mind you, like the way we were going to get signups was like go like person to person and like pitch our idea and get them to sign up for it. So this is not even like, oh, we'll put it on a website. This was literally like, we put it on an iPad, and then we took the iPad from person to person. And it was, you know, and it was like, we like, for example, like the first night at South by Southwest, like everyone's lined up to like get their badge. And so we just like went down the group and just like pitched it person by person. And so we actually ended up getting like 250 people, because it turns out like you can't really pitch 1,000 people. I mean, there was only two of us and we got really tired. But that was the very, very initial seed list. That and probably like haranguing friends and family. And then through that, we met a woman who was a journalist who wrote for Mother Jones. And she was basically very interested in this angle of women in tech. And she wrote kind of like a very early expose of women in tech, and then sort of cited us as like a group that was trying to make it better. So that probably got us another like couple hundred. And I think at that point we were like up to 600. And then it was just, you know, like obviously at that point we did have a website. We had like skillcrush.com. And then it was just, you know, it was just like send out a newsletter, put it on social media, like try to get them to tell your friends, you know what I mean? And just like rinse and repeat, you know, very slowly and surely.
Very organically.
Yeah.
I like that. I think that's the way to grow though, right?
Yes. I don't know. I mean, at the time, this is right around the time that like Code Academy came out, and they like tweeted and like Michael Bloomberg like retweeted it, and they got like 200,000 signups. So I was in there like, I'm doing everything wrong. But I think, you know, those stories are just there to make the rest of us feel bad about ourselves. So,
well, jumping up to today to make us feel better about ourselves now, how many students have you guys had come through Skill Crush to this point?
So it's funny. I like have the thing up to like look up the exact number. I think that we're looking at somewhere in the 15,000 range.
Wow.
I'm trying to see if I can find the exact amount. Yeah, I mean, I think that's about right. It might be a little bit lower, like 13,000 or something like that. But we sign up a fair amount of students a month. I mean, we do about 300 students a month at least, or thereabouts. And we've had months where we've had 500 students sign up. So I think, you know, we're a much less expensive option than a lot of like our, you know, or I don't know if it's like our competitors, but sort of other options like boot camps and stuff like that. So I think for that reason, we tend to get a fair amount of students. But what is crazy about that is that it's like 80 to 90% women.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of going back to like your original ethos, right?
Very much so. Yeah. Yeah. And I think recently we've done some digging into our demographics, because, you know, it's not something like normally when you sign up for a service online that you say like, I'm a woman. So it's not always easy for us to really be clear on what percentage is men and women, but, we have done a little bit of demographic surveying and the percentage honestly surprised me. I thought it was going to be a higher percentage or more evenly split, but it actually isn't. So
what would you say is the most challenging part of putting together and, you know, continuing to update, monitor, you know, manually help students with doing high quality online courses like what you guys do?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask it for a business. And I was like, oh God, everything. That part is not so hard. I mean, you know, obviously at this point, like I have a huge instructor team. So I have like an instructor team of 10 people who all, you know, work anywhere between like 50% time to 100% time. And all they do is support students. So there's answering student questions, doing video office hours, monitoring the forums, live chat, all of that. I mean, I don't know that I would say it's hard. I think it's just like, students need a lot of support. You know, there's just a lot of manpower and like, there's some ways to automate that, but like not that much, honestly. Like I think that, you know, the best improvements we can make is just on workflow and processes and like tools that we're using. So that, you know, students don't go missing. Like we've definitely had to iterate a lot on the tools that we use because there was definitely times where like, you know, when you've got like 10 or 20 students, you can use like a really like, you know, a basic sort of forum thing, but then you know, it gets to 50 and you're like, I can't actually keep track. Like even like I'm here and I want to answer all the questions, but it's actually impossible to keep track of which questions are getting answered. You know what I mean? So like, it's definitely been an evolution in terms of as we've grown, you know, what works for 10, 20, even 50 students starts to like completely fall apart when you get to like 300 students or like right now, I mean, active students, we probably have like over 1,000 active students at the moment. Wow. So how do you manage all of them? Yeah. So, and that is an ongoing process that, to be perfectly honest with you, is not something I'm like working on day to day. That's something that I have fortunately delegated to wonderful people who are way better at it than I am, because this is not a strength of mine. Yeah, but I would just say, you know, like one of the things that I think has helped us a lot is just continually really focusing on it and really prioritizing the support aspect of it.
All right, Ada, well, I want to transition over to a few of my frequently asked questions now, and I designed them to be intentionally short on my end. Your answers do not need to be equally as so.
Sounds good.
What would be your number one piece of advice to someone who wants to start an online related business today?
I think that the advice I would give to someone who wants to do an online business is exactly the same I'd give to anyone doing any business, which is, you know, I feel like often people come to me and I'm like here to like crush people's hopes and dreams. And I think in the end, this is motivating, but I don't know that people always feel that way. But the most important thing is like you have to get clear about who your customer is. And then it's basically be attached to, you know, and I heard someone say this recently, so this is, don't think this is my quote, it was something to the effect of like, get attached to the customer, not the problem. So you basically have a choice. Do you want to execute this like perfect idea that you have in your head? In which case I would not call that a business. I think that is a project, which is fine, right? Like there's lots of people who do artistic projects or whatever. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I think it's just important to not conflate that with what a business is. And what a business is identifying a customer and understanding their problem and then solving that problem. And I think that, you know, this thing I described that this mistake we had made of kind of having a solution in search of a problem is the number one most common mistake. And I would actually say like, 90% of people who are out there like starting quote unquote businesses, that's what they're doing. They have a solution in mind and they are searching for someone with a problem. And it's, you know, it is going to lead you down a bad path of unhappiness.
Much harder to sell.
Yes. Well, I mean, yeah, it just isn't. Yeah. The more you can really, you know, like all of our successes at Scalecrush is because we focus so much on our customer. Like we, last year, or in January, we sort of pulled some data and we had done 300 user interviews over the course of the year. And each user interview is like 30 to 45 minutes of like, two to three people from the Skillfresh team talking to one customer about whatever their pain point. And frankly, like 300, I'm like, we need to do 600, you know, like, and ironically, you know, at the end of the day, like, or I'm sort of really lucky, I guess, that, but I guess I don't really think it's lucky. I think this is how it works. Like, I think in the end, I have a business that perfectly, like, it totally exceeds all of my wildest hopes and dreams of what it could have been when I was just starting. And I think that people fear that when they focus on the customer, that it's gonna, they're gonna end up like selling diet pills or something, you know, like, or I don't know, something like totally terrible like that. But I think you kind of, you really have to change your mindset and understand that this is like, this is a collaboration you're entering into. You're, you know what I mean? And like, it, like, if you're not solving their problem, then like what you're doing is wasted time and energy. And you also, you can't possibly ask someone to pay for something if it's not actually something they need or want. But like in my experience, really focusing on the customer and solving their problem leads to a product that like exceeds your wildest imaginations and just has features and functionality that you could never have thought of. And it's amazing. And I recommend it for everyone. Plus, I think it's like how you make millions of dollars. So I'm like, why wouldn't anyone do it this way?
I love the word collaboration in this context too. So Ada, do you have any particular strategies, tactics, ideas, or things that you've tested with Skillcrush that come to mind that ended up being a failure?
I mean, like 95% of what we think is a good idea. I mean, I would say that we are, I feel like our hit rate is actually very close to zero in terms of things that we think are a good idea that actually work out. So whether that is sales pages or new features or new class topics or like everything, which is why like the only path forward is to have a really good, you know, sort of discovery user customer driven discovery process. The good news is that like, I do think that we tend to not be far off. Like we tend to be like maybe 5 degrees off. But I don't know that anything has been the right thing right out of the gate. And it has always benefited from testing basically. And that's just why you have to have a process for that and just build that into the DNA of your company. And honestly, like, you know, when you do that testing, the more varied your tests can be, the better, because like we've definitely had times where we've been like two tests that are relatively similar than one like wild flat card, you know, and like usually it's the wild card that wins. So.
Well, Ada, this is my last question for you. What's been the best investment you've ever made in the context of growing your business? And this could be in the form of time, money, tools, products, services, people, or otherwise.
It's funny. I mean, I've obviously invested in a million different things. For me personally, like I am a product person. So the whole marketing side of the business did not come naturally to me. So every investment I made in terms of buying online programs or hiring people to help me with that, especially early on in the business has paid off, you know, manifold. And I think, something that you do want to think about is investing in your own knowledge and sort of thinking about yourself as an asset in this context, and not being too cheap in terms of your investments. You know, that said, like I remember paying for a program, like a marketing program that cost $2,000. And at the time I like was sweating bullets because I was like, I don't know if this is worth it. And now like the irony of that, like I have probably made like $2 million off of the things that I had learned in that class. And obviously not exclusively off the things that I learned in that class, but every piece of knowledge sort of builds you up. So it is really hard though. I mean, it's so hard when you're getting started because like you're basically running on fumes and like hope and a prayer, and spending money is just difficult, but it is, you know, like, and my dad said this to me once. He was like, you know, a lot of successful business people look back and they say like the actual hourly rate that they were making in those first couple of whatever days was actually like $10,000 an hour. But like, you don't know that. And it's kind of like a big lottery ticket that you're spending a lot of money on. So I'm not sure if I'm being helpful, but those things do pay
off.
That's
great. Take a longer term view of them.
Yes. And like, however long you think it's going to be, like quadruple it. And then you're kind of maybe in the right realm of thinking. So,
yeah. All right. Well, Ada, thank you for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening today where they can go to learn more about you, Skillcrush, and everything you guys are doing?
Yeah, you can just go to skillcrush.com, and that really will lead you to everything. We're also on Instagram and Twitter @Skillcrush. But I think that just going to the website is the best thing. We have a really great free 10-day bootcamp that I encourage you to check out, especially if you're interested in coding and exploring that. Sort of allows you to dip your toes in. And yeah.
All right. Well, Ada, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of the Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.